Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 900. My name is Cam DeBusey. Delighted to be back today. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, and I've got some special guests with us today in a very special occasion that we're recording. Today we're celebrating the 300th anniversary, the tricentennial of the RCUS, the Reformed Church in the United States. I don't know the specific date. I don't think it's today, but this year, the whole year, we're celebrating the tricentennial. And what better day could we do it? Episode 900, we'll just divide that by three and we get 300 years. So we love that. We're talking today with two very special guests. Let me introduce to you first someone that some attendees to our conference may know, Dr. Maynard Koerner, who serves as president of Heidelberg Theological Seminary in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He also serves as professor of ministerial studies and director of the Doctor of Ministry degree program at the Philippines program of Heidelberg Theological Seminary, if I've got that correct. And he serves as associate pastor of Trinity RCUS there. Welcome, Maynard. It's great to see you again.
Good to be with you. A couple of those duties have been passed on to others by now, but right.
We'll have to update my staff and let them know.
The problem probably is our website needs to be updated.
We'll get that taken care of. But it's great to have you with us, and we're thankful for your time and your willingness to talk. We also have with us today Mr. Wayne Johnson, who serves, if it's correct, as provost of City Seminary of Sacramento, as well as an elder of Covenant Reformed Church of Sacramento and RCUS congregation. Welcome, Wayne. It's great to see you too.
Welcome. I've been retired from the eldership for a number of years. So
yeah.
my life before that was I was a political consultant that took me all over the world and came out of college with a history degree, and I edited Laban magazine for 10 years. And
absolutely.
So church history was kind of a thing for me. So once I got retired, I really got busy.
Yeah, it's funny how that happens, isn't it? I've had many friends that tell me that's the case. So we'll have to see what happens to me. Who knows? Maybe I'll drop dead before I retire. But I was like retraining, not retiring, so to speak. I've heard that one too. Well, I'm glad to have both of you with me today. We're going to be speaking about, as I mentioned, the RCUS, or the Reformed Church in the United States, 300 years. I serve as the denominational historian for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and we're just about ready to hit our 90th, and that's kind of old relative to some other denominations. So to talk about the history of the Reformed Church in the U.S., and even before that, the heritage and the history behind this particular denomination, I'm really quite excited to talk about that. And there's going to be lots of intersection and touch points with several other ecclesiastical bodies, no doubt. So if people are listening and they don't know much about the RCUS or about particular German Reformed congregations, you're certainly going to find something that interests you and something that's very important nonetheless. But brothers, I'll just open up by asking you, what are some of the celebrations that we have in store? I know Ryan, Noah, and I are planning to come out to Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, coming to Rapid City in June. What do you have lined up for this celebration?
Well, because I'm retired, they made me chairman of this event. So it's another full-time job I've taken on.
Yeah.
We have a great, it's a family convention, an abbreviated synod occurring at the same time, with a special celebration at Mount Rushmore. Our co-sponsored there by the local groups of the Sons of the American Revolution and the DAR and the Mount Rushmore Society and so forth and so forth. So it's looking to be a lot of fun. We're going to have a lot of breakout sessions. A good chance for hundreds and hundreds of people to get together. We're scattered around, so we don't get to get together that much. So it's really maybe once every 100 years. But I assure you, I will not chair the next one because it's been a lot of work. We've got Kyle Mann is going to be there with us, who's the editor in chief at the Babylon Bee, because it's a little bit of a focus on the colonial era, which was, a lot of people don't realize, how important that was. But just referencing what you said, kind of what laid the groundwork for the church here, you've really got to go back to to Germany and Switzerland in the early days. And it starts as simple as Zwingli versus Luther, you know, and that's sort of the first generation division that happened inside the churches, the Protestant churches. And, you know, 5 years before, you know, the colloquy at Marburg, you've got Zwingli on one side and Luther on the other supporting or opposing the Peasants' Rebellion, you know, and so the peasant wars that broke out, and Luther, of course, you know, he allied himself with the aristocracy and the princes, and there were 100,000 people slaughtered. But Zwingli, on the other hand, supported he supported the peasants on that side, and particularly the 12 articles, you know, that came out of the Swabian League. And you read that today, and it's in sort of the first really clear statement of the rights of the church and the rights of the people in the pews that really laid a foundation. And that sort of carried through. You see that influence all the way through. It happened certainly in Heidelberg when Frederick died and his son Ludwig Louis took over, and he was a Lutheran. And the first thing he did, 600 Reformed pastors were let go, you know, and he followed the practice of a lot of people declaring that it had to be Lutheran only. When he died, Frederick's son was too young, and so John Casimir came in to oversee him, and he was, you know, solidly Reformed. He was he worked with Queen Elizabeth and with Philip Sidney and the whole Protestant League, trying to protect all of Protestantism. He led the troops in for the Huguenots. He went into the liberation of Holland. I mean, they were very offensive in their theology, very defensive in their military adventures. It was always, you know, trying to protect and extend the Reformed faith. But when they took over back in Heidelberg, they didn't turn all the Lutherans loose. They allowed them to stay unless, as long as they didn't, you know, harangue and create discord. Well, of course they did. But that idea of the principle of religious liberty, you saw it several generations later. Frederick V's daughter, Elizabeth Palatine, she became the abbess of Hereford, and she took in all the political or all the religious refugees. Anybody, you know, they could get sanctuary there. Well, some of them were friends of William Penn. And so when, you know, he dedicates one of his books to her, and he opens up Pennsylvania to German Reformed immigration, which was, well, you know, the story, you know, really starts of our church really starts there. Right. But they were coming out. They were refugees, either coming directly or they went to London first. And Queen Anne settled them in New York and New Jersey, another big group of the German Reformed there. But once they got there, they had no pastors. And so that was a huge problem. You know, you had all these, it could have been 15, it could have been 20. We don't know how many, you know, were actually German Reformed. We know that 80% of the people that came were either German or Reformed or Lutheran. Hmm. But when they settled, you know, there were little church groups that were springing up, and they had their Heidelbergs and they had their Bibles, and they were surrounded with a lot of, you know, sort of pietistic offshoots that were, you know, growing in the absence of ministers in general. And finally, three congregations prevailed upon a school teacher who had arrived about 4 years earlier by the name of John Philip Boehm, B-O-E-H-M. And they prevailed upon him to be their pastor. And he really didn't want to do it because he wasn't ordained. His dad had been a
just that
minister.
Minor problem.
We're the only denomination founded, Reformed denomination founded by an unordained man. And so in 1725, but hey, the church is the church, you know, and in the absence of.
If I may, it's also important to remember that these are refugees. So they're very often very uneducated peasant type people.
Yeah.
And they're committed to having a church and serving their Christ. And so they're looking for somebody to teach them and lead them in their Christian endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he took the first three congregations. The first thing he did, he said, you got to have a constitution. So he wrote up a constitution, and those three churches adopted it in 1725. And so then in October, they had the first communion service and 3 became 11, you know, churches, and that they adopted it across all of those. They adopted basically the same constitution. But in the interim, Reverend Weiss showed up and he was ordained and he was having none of it. Of course, he settled in Philadelphia and complained about the idea that this unordained man was, you know, setting up all these churches. So Boone took off up to New York. There were a group of low church Dutch Reformed fellows. They met with him. They ordained him. And that began an association that would play a real big part in the German Reformed history.
That was the Classis of Amsterdam, wasn't it?
That's what came out of that. Okay. Yeah, this was the New York guys. But when they came back and Weiss went over, and Weiss was helpful in getting the Classis of Amsterdam to come in and to support the churches. And so we came under the Dutch care for, pick it up there, Maynard.
It is also actually the case. I had not known this and just recently discovered this, that it was the German Reformed consistory in Heidelberg, Germany, knowing of what was happening in Pennsylvania, who officially, because they were not able to, communicate it to the church in Holland and say, would you help our brothers in Pennsylvania? And that's what started. So the Synod of Holland requested that Classis Amsterdam provide the oversight, and that's the base upon which the church was able to start. They provided a lot of financial support, and then also the oversight, the authority by which pastors were ordained, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, looking to New York and New Jersey for a moment, you know, the Queen Anne had settled how many was it? 75,000. How many actually ended up in London? But it was about 16,000, I think, that came in the first.
20,000 Germans who were camped in refugee camps outside of London in 1710.
Right. And I think the first wave was 16,000 came to New York, and they apprenticed them to people, and the Dutch Reformed took them under their wing. And one of them, interestingly enough, was John Peter Zenger, who any journalism student knows that name. Zenger, he's this young guy. He's apprenticed to John Bradford, who's a printer. And he would come in every Monday morning to the print shop. He'd collected all the Dutch Reformed sermons. He would prevail upon Bradford to print them all. Mm-hmm. And then he'd run around town and distribute all the sermons. And so he was really close to these guys. But the Dutch were divided between the sort of the aristocracy that were, you know, much closer to the British, and then the Leicester type people that, you know, were later, you know, you'd see the Leicester Rebellion, they were very, sort of more colonial in their thing, more American in their thinking. And so he eventually had his own print shop and founded a newspaper, and he starts haranguing, you know, the corruption of Governor Cosby. Well, that is under British law at that time. Libel is criticizing. Doesn't matter if it's true. You criticize, it was libel. So he gets thrown in prison. His wife, Anna, she takes over, and she becomes America's first female newspaper publisher. And the paper continues. So all the time he's in prison. So he gets two guys, two lawyers in New York, agree to defend him. Cosby immediately disbars him for life, right? And so he goes into the trial with no defense. In walks Andrew Hamilton, who was a Scot, who a very famous lawyer at the time in Philadelphia, and he shows up and agrees on the spot to be Zenger's defense counsel, which kind of throws everything in. And Cosby changes the judge, gets a crony, you know, but they have the trial, and so Hamilton argues that the truth is a sure defense. He said, I've never been in a British court where the truth didn't matter. And the jury took 10 minutes to acquit him And, you know, and I mean, this is jury nullification. This is, you know, you know, like an act of rebellion. And so he's looked upon, that was, they say that, you know, the verdict heard around the world, you know, preceded Lexington and Concord, you know, by a generation. But it he's often called the father of the First Amendment. And John Peter Zenger, you know, we would look to him. I mean, he was very close and raised up under the Dutch Reformed after he got here. But the whole cause of liberty and you know, being able to speak without fear of church or state was, that ran pretty deep, you know, among these people. And you see it all through leading up to the revolution and the strong antipathy of the German Reformed to, well, they didn't like the French, obviously, because of the 30 Years' War, you know, they're here because of that. You know, they didn't like that. And, you know, they had, one of the old guys told me one time, I was talking to him, he said, well, they thought that both the church and the state were too big for their britches. You know, this kind of was their attitude. And there's a little of that, but you certainly saw it in the political realm. When the revolution's coming, the German Reform were very, very strongly on the colonial side. 20% of the German Reform pastors volunteered as chaplains in the Continental Army, which is, you know, just a staggering, when you think that, you know, volunteering meant that first year, you meant you were going to go with Washington to Valley Forge and all of the depredations and things that we hear about. And these guys were amazing. One of the first guys he met was a fellow by the name of Peter, that Washington met in Germantown, was Peter Hummerkaus, one of the first guys to volunteer, the first company to come out of that region to go join the Continental Army. And Hummerkaus, you know, would play a very important role. He was, he crossed the Delaware, Washington both times, officer of the day at Saratoga. He was part of the flying camp, probably one of the guards, but we don't know. You know, Washington had originally had two English speaking people from every colony that were appointed to be his personal guard. And they tried to kill him. There was an assassination plot. They didn't trust him. So he started grabbing his own people, and the records were all destroyed, so we can't tell exactly who was who, but a lot of these guys were the Germans, Lutheran and Reformed, who was very close to his personal guard. And at the end, Hummerkaus was a captain by now. He reenlists twice and gets called upon to, he was a carriage maker by trade. So he took this 8 wagon loads of powder to Yorktown at the request of Washington. And of course, that pretty much needed, that was the final battle of, you know, the war. And so he and his wife Mary are buried at the Hagerstown German Reformed Church. You know, people can go visit the grave, but he's remembered as, you know, as quite a prominent character in the war. Some of the other ones I'd mentioned, of course, Baron von Steuben is you know, every school kid learns that name. He was the right German Prussian officer who came over and whipped the guys. He took these farmers and whipped them into a Continental Army to beat the British. When he retired after the war, he retired to New York, became an elder in the German Reformed Church there. You can see the, you know, the close relationships, you know, that developed between the German Reform. In fact, when he was inaugurated, President Washington wrote a letter, public letter, thanking the pastors and elders of the German Reformed Church for their stand, you know, for the cause of liberty. They hid the Liberty Bell in our church in Allentown. It was another. Governor Heaster, probably in Maryland, you know, was Captain Heaster. He was imprisoned on the Jersey prison ship in Wallabout Bay in New York, you know, and when you think about the number of casualties, you had what, 4,500 people killed during the actual war. 11,500 died on the prison ships. Wow. You know, if you go to Brooklyn, there's a monument there where they still see bones every few years. Bones wash up and they collect them all. But there's many buried under the monument there to all those who died. But he was a Heaster, who went on to become governor of Maryland, you know, and remained very prominent in not only politics, but in the Reformed Church. He was a captain, got imprisoned on the Jersey ship, immediately went about organizing trying to get taking care of the sick, trying to organize the men and, you know, boost morale. And so the British offered him up as a prisoner exchange to get him off the ship. So that saved his life. And you know, which was a benefit to the people of Maryland, but he was a well-known fellow at the time as well. So there's just numerous stories, you know, of you know, so many of the men, you know, sure, entered, you know, service, you know, during the war.
Well, so we could maybe pick up the thread again with the more of the original organization of the church, as we said, three congregations, which. And the 300 years is not 300 anniversary of a synod, but 300 years since the first church,
yes,
was organized.
Yes.
So in 1747, under direction of the Classis Amsterdam, a fellow by the name of Pastor Schlatter was sent to organize the churches. And so what they did, it was called a CETUS, spelled C-E-O-T-U-S. So that they were, the authority was in the church in Holland, but the churches in the United States organized and met as a synod would, and did all of the things that a synod does, only they did not have the authority to make all the final decisions, particularly ordaining men for the ministry.
Mm.
And so that first organization of a denomination-wide took place in 1747.
And there were churches, not just in Pennsylvania, but, you know, I was raised in Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. And as we head up or down the valley, I mean, strange about Shenandoah Valley, it's the only one that runs.
Yeah, if you go down
the valley, you're going north. Right, sure. Right. Yeah. So, but as you go down through the valley, you know, you're going to in Strasbourg and all those areas, a lot of German settlements. There's old RCUS churches.
Yeah.
You can see the buildings and Friedenskirche and, you know, some of the others that are down there that and I've been to, you know, a number of those old church buildings. But they were an interesting bunch. And again, they were they tended not to support the war because they were almost all anti-slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, the very, very strong current that ran through the German churches. So it was an interesting time. You know, Beam, when he traveled, he went on horseback, covered 25,000 miles up and down the eastern seaboard organizing churches. I mean, I can't even comprehend. I've
probably
been on
more
a
than one
mile
horse
trail ride before, and I got, you know, that's a long couple of hours, you know? But imagine just on your own setting out, writing church constitutions, organizing congregations.
Sure.
And sometimes he'd walk in and do, you know, baptize half the congregation.
Yeah.
Because they hadn't baptized him because they hadn't seen a preacher in 10 years, you know. So he was just a remarkable guy. He's referred to as the father of the German Reformed Church, mm-hmm, in America.
In fact, the shortage of pastors was one of the biggest issues that we dealt with. Mm-hmm. First of all, getting them ordained and getting them approved for ordination from Holland, that was not an easy task to do, given the situation. When we actually went to the point of ending that relationship, which happened in 1793, there were 88 congregations and 55 of them were vacant. So that speaks to a tremendous need for
amazing
putting people into pulpits. And I think quite honestly that does also speak to the fact that the churches had their struggles. A church needs regular ministry and there is a short supply.
Deprivation in the church was was a real thing, but it was primarily spiritual. I mean, these people, they were hardworking and industrious, and they, you know, you could drop them anywhere and they'd, I mean, as we'll get to a little later, the Volga Germans came in and you drop them in North Dakota and, you know, what are you going to do in North Dakota? Well, they saw dirt, they saw water, they saw sun, you know, and pretty soon, you know, the whole state's covered with whatever they were planting, beets, yeah, wheat, whatever.
Milo.
Anyway,
if we want to advance a little bit, by 1793, is when the church decided it was time to, not over any issues, but it was just simply the difficulty of training men here in the States and getting them ordained, that they decided it was time to sever the tie with the church in Holland and to become a self-supporting under their own authority. And so it went from being a sedus to being a synod. That took place in 1793. In which, of course, they had to adjust their constitution, but it was a solid Reformed church committed to the Dutch Reformed creeds, the three forms of unity, as we know them, as we know them today. But one of the first big issues, well, two really big issues, you can imagine. One was the language problem. Soon that became, you know, there were some churches who wanted to go to an English language, and that was a difficult thing to deal with. And the second one was training men for the ministry.
I think the other, it is interesting, you know, because a lot of people think of the German Reformed as having only the Heidelberg Catechism. And, you know, I've gone back through the records, and when the first churches were formed, I remember Rieger was one of the elders there, and I think Whitmarsh, who was having difficulty with the canons. But I don't see a reference to... they adopted the canons, you know, and he was given an exception, something that never happened later. We didn't give exceptions, but the Belgic was not, you know, I can't find that it ever really is. It's not mentioned in their records and what happened.
Except they would refer to the Dutch creeds, and my
yeah, they did
that in the Dutch, they didn't necessarily, distinguish them in that way, but the Dutch creeds always included the Belgian Confession.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, that is what the creeds were at that point in time. Now, there's a real history in which there's a lot of history lost, but eventually when we move ahead quite a ways in 1848, there's a constitution which requires adherence to the creed, except that the only creed that is mentioned is the Heidelberg Catechism. But there's all that history in between that.
Of course.
Yeah, in practice. Well, it's understandable as well, because, you know, you're dealing with farmers, you're dealing with people out on the frontier. You've got, you know, at the turn of the 18th to the 19th century, by the time we come to the 20th century, you've got 3,000 German Reformed churches, 1,500 of them in Pennsylvania, and half of the other half in Ohio. That was the Northwest Synod. And yet the more you get out among, you know, the common folks, you know, they wanted free prayer, and we'll talk about Mercersburg in a minute, you know, because that was a 100-year battle in our church, over Mercersburg. They wanted free prayer. They wanted simple service. They wanted a pulpit ministry, not an altar ministry. And so there were, the seeds of the conflict, you know, were, you can see what was going to happen. It was going to be, as the old, what they call them, the old Reformed. And if we look at it, you know, you always try to figure out, well, who are my guys when you look at your history, you know, and, you know, are you a Federalist or an Anti-Federalist? Well, you know, it turns out we're all both, you know, I mean, you read one side, I like that. You read the other side. Well, yeah, they got a good point too. And there's a little of that that goes on here, but on balance, you're going to find that Mercersburg, most people in the German Reformed tradition, you know, it's a pretty dark period for us. Why don't we talk about the seminary for a little bit? Because there's been interest in Nevin and Schaff and so forth, you know, of recent years.
Absolutely.
I will, as I mentioned, in 1793, when then the church faced the question of training our own men. And what happened for the first number of years is that men who were pastors would take other men under their wings. Actually, they lived with them in the parsonage, and they were trained men. And there were actually three fairly popular and strong men who did that for a number of years. But once we get into the 1820s, there was an increasing desire to find a way to have a seminary. And there were a number of starts and difficulties, raising the money for professors, all of those sorts of things.
That both of us know about.
Right, yes.
Nothing's new. Yeah.
But really get into. In fact, it's very interesting. The first man they actually elected to be the kind of an interesting story. I can't give you the exact in terms of what this money is worth, but the first man they elected to be the professor was given a salary of $2,000, and that just would cost a great uproar because it would have been more than twice as much as the ordinary pastor would have made. So we can't even imagine what that was like. What all of this leads up to is with several starts and stops and moving, in 1835, the seminary was located in Mercersburg, Pennsylvania. There was a college there, Marshall College, offered up.
Carlisle, then they moved to Mercersburg.
This is also now, you need to put into context two things that are very important here. This is about the time when you start having what I would refer to very general way, American frontier revivalism. And you had the preaching of revivals and so on, even Charles Finney. You also have at the same time the rise of the scholarship in Germany, of the liberal, the anti-supernatural movements that are going on there, Hegel, Schleiermacher. Those things are very much going on at that point in time. And like always is with an immigrant church, obviously what comes from the old country has got to be the best. And so they would go back to Germany and look for scholars. And what they didn't know is the influence that all those scholars from Germany was Hegel. Now, along with that, so there was a professor by the name of Friedrich Rau. He was only there for a few years, but he planted the seeds. At this time, there's another professor who is American-born and is actually trained under Charles Hodge at Princeton.
Mm.
By the name of John Nevin.
Yep.
And Charles Hodge was considered him to be the upcoming Calvinist theologian and professor, and recommended him highly. And it's an amazing thing, just to kind of, you know, there's a lot of history there, of course, but he taught at Pittsburgh Seminary, but he knew of the German Reform and was asked to teach then eventually at Mercersburg. And he read a book by Neander, and within a matter of weeks, he became a thoroughgoing Hegelian. If we can imagine.
Yeah, the bad synthesis.
And found himself to be a kindred spirit. Now, at the same time, or virtually fairly soon after he became the professor, they were looking for a second professor, and they went to Germany. And a very popular preacher in Germany, considered to be conservative by the name of Krummacher, was asked to be the professor. He turned it down, but he recommended that they get this young scholar who was the up-and-coming scholar in Germany by the name of Philip Schaff. Philip Schaff learned his theology and philosophy in a thoroughgoing Hegelian school.
Mm.
Learning. So he came in 1836, I believe, when he came to the States. I'm maybe a little bit off on that date. And so Nevin and Schaff are the professors.
Mm-hmm.
They are kindred spirits with each other. And their view of history, their view of the church, is thoroughgoing Hegelian philosophy.
Mm.
And that sets the stage for then what we refer to as development of Mercersburg theology. And as Wayne just said a moment ago, that's not a very good history.
I think the church was so unprepared. I mean, there were a few who saw it. You know, he immediately got hit with a heresy charge as soon as Schaff hit the shores. You know, he was called before the Senate for the classes. But he goes on the heresy trial. He'd written a book called The Principle of Protestantism.
Mm.
And The Principle of Protestantism was basically a Hegelian view that, well, you had Rome, and then you have the Reformation, the Reformed churches, and that's the thesis and the antithesis. And now what's next? It's to bring everything back together in a new church. And so you've got this, the whole beginning of the modern ecumenical movement, which is carried on by the Mercersburg Review right up through the whole century. in full fruition in the 20th century. But, you know, Schaff was in the room in Berlin during the Friedrich Schelling lectures. And Bakunin is in that room, in that lecture hall, and Marx and Engels are both in that in their lecture hall. And and I was going to say the other guy in the hall was Kierkegaard was there too. So I mean, all these guys were getting both barrels of the new Hegelianism, mm-hmm. which was German idealism on crack, you know. And so he goes from there to England on his way here, where he's meeting with what would become the Tractarian group. And when he arrives here, he's got this idea that, what we've got to do is merge all this together. Now, there's another feature of it. I don't know that we really want to get it. You know, there's a revival of Nevin acolytes out there. We've got friends who've written books. I mean, you know, I know. And there's a side of Nevin talking about the anxious bench and all the things that were wrong with the revivalist movement, and so they articulated, let's go back to the creeds, let's go back to the liturgy. But see, then I think Maynard, you said earlier when we spoke, you said it was an overreaction. They went completely the other direction. And they ended up with a very high church movement. You know, they put the altars in the churches, candles came in, giant stained glass windows you'll see all through Pennsylvania, you know, of Jesus. And, you know, which we, you know, the old Reform didn't think much of, you know, I mean, they thought a lot of the second commandment, you don't try to image God. They believed in free prayer. The Mercersburg guys said, Nope. We're not going to have some farmer up there sputtering out prayers. They're going to have to read the prayers that we write for them. And so just culturally, there was and theologically, there was quite a division. And that battle went on for 100 years.
So as I said, you have the revivalism, the frontier movement, and then you have the answer to that, which there was, of course, a lot of problems and probably wasn't that solid reform. You have a whole lot of more in the way of Emeraldianism, which only have in the Heidelberg Catechism. Yeah. The Heidelberg Catechism is, of course, absolutely reformed, mm-hmm. but it didn't have to deal with the canons of Dort. And then the answer to that revivalism was based on the Hegelian philosophy. And so you have the wrong answer given an overreaction to the revivalism. That's what you end up with Mercersburg. There's a lot of similarities, in fact, with Mercersburg and a lot of the things that are going on today in terms of a high church movement, et cetera, federal vision.
Well, not just that,
but
also
vision theology. There's some themes that are similar.
Yeah, the federal vision people love these guys too. You know, right. So I mean, you can see where that comes from.
Church sacramentalism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty high on the candle,
we say.
There's a lot to read.
There's
a lot
that we could get into, but by 1855, Schaff and Nevin have moved on. There have been attempts at heresy trials. They never won the day. But it left the legacy from the last half of the 1800s of great battles between a liturgical movement and a more pietistic movement, and a very low view of scripture turned out to be a very, the church became very much an American social gospel type church. All of those sorts of themes you find in the latter half of the 1800s.
Goodness.
Well, I think it's a perfect entree to, I'm of Swedish descent, raised in a Southern Baptist church, so I'm kind of a Gentile among these folks, you know. But when our church in Sacramento applied to become part of the old Eureka classes, you know, it was a very, very German denomination. You could still hear a lot of that Volga German dialect, you know, in a lot of the churches. And And yet theologically, they were just rock solid, you know, and so we were very attracted to that, their high view of scripture. And so I start looking into what's the background, you know, where did these guys come from? Well, the German Reformed Church got a shot in the arm when that latter wave of Russian Germans, they left Germany under Catherine, left Germany for Russia when Catherine the Great opened up some land for them.
If we go back to the middle 1700s, so now we have a whole nother, and it's interesting when you look at history, how God brings things about. But from the 1750s on, you have a tremendous amount of migration of Germans to Russia. They were invited by Catherine the Great to come to the steppes in Russia. But it wasn't only Reformed. There was also Lutheran and Roman Catholic.
Mennonite, yeah.
And in Russia, they lived in, they called them colonies, and they were Reformed colonies and Lutheran colonies and Roman Catholic, etc. For the most part, there was some sharing between Lutheran and Reformed, but for the most part, well, that's my history. I'm one of them. So after 100 years, those promises were all forgotten. They got free land. Their sons would never have to serve in the military. They could maintain their German language, teach their own children, and so all of that was taken away by 1860s, 1870s. Yeah. Well, 1862 is when the United States opened up land in the Dakotas and Nebraska for homestead.
It's kind of a tough year for the U.S.
So
yeah, middle of the war.
And so, as I said, not to make it too personal, but just to see how this happened, in 1872, my great-grandfather came from Russia, landed in Yankton, South Dakota, and went north by ox cart about 45, 50 miles and homesteaded.
Wow.
And the history shows that within a year of them, and there were others there, he had grown children, there was a Reformed church. And so I can't prove it, but I would challenge anybody to disprove it. But this kind of note here. Here's my story. Since he was obviously Reformed when he came over, which I would say means he lived in a Reformed colony in Russia, which means he came from the Palatinate in Germany. So that's my history, all the way back to the Palatinate.
Yeah. They were remarkable stories, you know, because. When, you know, to fast forward, I know we got some time. We probably want to get to the modern era. By the time you get to the 20th century, you know, we've got this influx that's come in the Eureka Classis, which was also designated in terms, the dialect played a large role in
Let me talk about that a minute, if I may. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
So with these Germans from Russia, they, of course, are Germans, and they join the German Reformed Church. But they soon find out that they are not kindred with what is going on in the huge denomination.
Yeah.
So in 1910, a number of pastors, not all German-Russian, some who had, there's some theology I can talk about in a moment, but they gathered in a small town in South Dakota and formed a separate classis, called it the Eureka Classis. Now, they did it under the guise, because constitutionally, you can only have one classis within a geographical area, unless it is a different language-speaking classis. So under the guise of being a German-speaking classis, they were really doing it for doctrinal reasons. They started the Eureka Classis, where there were also already the South Dakota and North Dakota classes. And that's the basis upon which then, moving a little bit faster forward, in 1934, the RCOS, as a large denomination, and give you a little bit of statistics here. In 1934, there were 8 synods.
Oh, wow.
1,776 congregations, 306,000 some communicant members. Mm. There were 8 synods and a general synod. And they determined everything was about union. Everything was about getting together. And so they had a proposed merger with German Lutheran Church, Evangelical Synod. And in that merger, you could hold to either the Heidelberg Catechism or Luther's Catechism, the one you pick, the one you like. And that merger took place. The vote to merge was in 1934. It was consummated in 1940. But the one classes, the Eureka classes, says we will not go with it. We will continue the RCOS as we know it. And so it went from 8 synods to now a small classes of about 10 congregations and 3, 4, 5 pastors.
It's a pretty interesting because, you know, when they did that, and within the first year after the merger documents were adopted, the president said that they were not a confessional church anymore. Hmm. And they basically, confessionalism was no longer required. So when it ended up in court, because they said, well, you know, because what had happened was, you know, we're the only denomination where all the liberals left. You know, we're still the Reformed Church, right? And they said, well, no, you can't be the Reformed Church because we were the Reformed Church. Yeah, but you formed a new denomination, you know. And so they went to court twice. And both times, thankful for this was a law, the way it was interpreted back then, they said, well, who holds to the founding documents?
Right.
Only the Eureka classes did. They said, well, you're the Reformed Church. You're this other church, people, but you guys are the Reformed Church. And so twice it was adjudicated, and twice the Reformed Church, albeit smaller, legally continued, you know, and doctrinally continued. But those were tough times after that. I mean, they were... I saw one meeting of the classes where they only had two or three ministers and an all sea of elders, and the elders you know would do reading sermons and so, but they held those churches together, you know, during some tough times until a church sent one of their sons to this place called Westminster Seminary. That was Lloyd Gross, right?
Maybe take us back for just a moment here. Yet, what was the impetus? And there was theology already back in Russia. There was a strong pietistic movement, and then there was an anti-pietistic movement. And there is a theologian who has a lot of bad rap, and rightfully so, but also a theologian by the name of Kohlberger, who was originally a pietist from Holland and Germany, and then he became very anti-pietistic, and he had a lot of influence. He was never in Russia, but his theology was known, his sermons were read by these people already in Russia and when they came over to the U.S., and he was taught these people, and they were committed with a love for Scripture and a love for the gospel as stated in the Heidelberg Catechism. And that's even though when they formed the Eureka classes in 1910, some of those men would probably not be as solidly five-point Calvinist as you and I are, but they were solid on Scripture, wow, and they were solid on the gospel message. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis upon which the Lord used them to continue the RCOS, which is kind of interesting because most conservative Nate Park churches today, as the OPC and others who had to form a new denomination, in our history, the Lord maintained the old denomination, even though we have all that history that's not so great. But yet, with the remnant through the German Russians, that remnant, and others as well. There were solid others in Iowa and other places that were not, in Wisconsin, that were not Germans from Russia as we are, but were solid. Now, eventually, the theology of Kohlberger became known by men who were his followers, neo-Kohlbergianism, and that became very anti-nomistic. And so we had that problem. But it's interesting how the Lord kept the church going by a strong commitment to Scripture.
I know what I was talking to Lloyd Gross. He's going to be with the Lord now. But he told me, he said, yeah, I got sent to the seminary. And they said, and remember, you know, spend as much time as you can. Listen to the guys who are talking about Kohlberger. Well, of course, nobody was talking about Kohlberger. So after the first semester, he's going, you know, Pastor, nobody's talking about Kohlberger.
Yeah.
There was one guy that had that would have a huge impact in the Reformed Church as you see it today. And there was one guy on the faculty there who was Reformed as a, as distinct from Presbyterian, and that was Cornelius Van Til. You know, and if the guy couldn't get through three sentences without slipping in a phrase that you recognize, your ear immediately recognizes Heidelberg language. Mm-hmm. And so he had a, you know, certainly Machen and the others had a big, and Murray, all those guys had big impacts, but the guy mm-hmm. who connected and they had confidence in. And so, you know, there was a time where, you know, it's probably a little broader today, but there was a time where when I would listen to all the early examinations, you know, I'd go to as a young man, and you know, it was Van Til, Van Til, Van Til. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, very, very strongly in terms of, you know, the presuppositional apologetics. Mm-hmm. But we were introduced as a denomination to the rest of the Reformed world. And so you're meeting other guys at the seminary that were going to back and serving in the OPC or maybe going to the PC, going somewhere else. And so more and more guys started going there. And, you know, our denomination has been saved. It was saved by, you know, of course, by the Lord, but it was the means were not only the old Reformed, you know, whatever their flaws, the Russian Germans, whatever their Coburgian, you know, mm-hmm. Flaws may have been. We once again and again, you know, we've other people have, you know, come along and the Lord has used Westminster to introduce us to the whole broad fellowship of the Reformed churches. We now have ministers coming, you know, a lot of guys from Greenville, a lot of, you know, your RTS there, you know,
Mid-America Reformed Center
from yeah. Heidelberg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Anselm from Heidelberg. Mm-hmm. We took in two from City Seminary, you know, last year. New Geneva has given us some. Reformed Episcopal Seminary. You know, so it's very interesting. We have two seminaries that are somewhat connected to the RCUS, City Seminary and Heidelberg, but we're not a denominational seminary. Mm. You know, the denomination, you know, we've run up that hill a couple times and they said, nah, we've been there.
So at any rate, for many years, we were simply known as the Eureka classes, one right. classes. That was always interesting. We didn't have a synod, but the Lord blessed it. And there were a number of independent congregations who were still left over from the old church and eventually came back in Iowa, Wisconsin, California. Kind of fast moving forward in 1985, we moved back into establishing a synod. The name Eureka Classes was set aside, and we organized with four classes and a synod in 1985.
We should probably take a moment, Maynard, and talk about, you know, because I know we only have a couple of minutes left here, right, Camden? Mm-hmm. And just talk about the church today, which is probably, it's probably the most united. I mean, you go to a synod meeting, and I'm just amazed at the unity that we have. You've got, I mean, there are the distinctives. Certainly the confessionalism is very, very strong.
Also pick up with, as I said, it was basically a Heidelberg seminary or yeah. Heidelberg catechism creed. But the men always held to the three forms of unity in terms of their doctrine.
Right.
But myself growing up, now keeping in mind that the confessional status of the new church was you could hold to either Heidelberg catechism or Luther's catechism.
Right.
So the idea of a multiple creed was anathema.
Right.
People in the pew as I grew up. So as we began to talk about, we really ought to think about readopting the Belzer Confession and Canons of Dort. That was a difficult hill to climb for people in the pews. Mm-hmm. But we did actually in 1995 readopt and fully hold to the three forms of unity as the creedal stand of the
right. Yeah, so it's a very strongly confessional church today, probably more so than any time in its history. There's a spirit of fellowship and unity that is just wonderful. I mean, there's we hold 6-day creation as confessional in the Reformed Church. I don't know that flies anywhere else, but we agree on it. You know, people say, well, why do you do something so divisive? I said, well, it doesn't divide us. It unites us. <You know? laughs> I mean, that's who we are. I mean, that's, you know, you say the thing about the RCUS, I mean, it's, we took in 7 new ministers and 3 new pastors at our last synod meeting, which is the most we've ever done in one bite. You know, we've got growth that's coming. We've got, churches, Filipino congregations, and we've got a lot of things happening that we look a quite bit different than the church looked in ages past. But it's a strong.
We don't have things that we stand up and have some pretty good arguments about. Of course, that's how church government works. Church policy works, but.
But it ends at the break.
That's right. That's right.
It ends at the break. I mean, it's and there's this wonderful idea of submission that in practice that people can argue and they can lose and they say, well, it's the Lord's government, it's the Lord's church, and I can submit to that. And I've seen some of those knockdown drag out conversations, but I've also seen that we've, you know, for a long time now, you know, it's been a long time since there's been any hard feelings. And that's just a remarkable thing, you know, because, you know, church government can be a fearsome thing. But we speak of the another unique thing is it would be different from the URC, for example. You know, we would think of them being more congregational. They hate to hear that phrase. You mean, and I don't use it disparagingly, but we speak of churches in organic union. We're one church, and so
yeah, you're not the Reformed churches in the U.S. You're the Reformed Church.
No, it's the Reformed Church in the United States. Yeah, and so this organic union. Even though, you know, we were in organic union, we're loath to step on the local consistory. We, in practice, we're a consistorial church, more so than the URC.
We do have a very reformed sense of polity.
If it's not confessional, if it's not constitutional.
Today, we are up to right around 50 congregations.
Mm.
We still have, of course, always struggled with vacancies.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a fairly robust home missions program, and we've cooperated. You may be remember we've worked with the OPC with foreign missions with Harvey Kahn,
yes,
and Lendl Smith,
yes,
and now we have a church that we support in the Philippines and in Kenya and in the Congo, and in fact, I can take the advantage here and put a plug in. Why wouldn't I? Heidelberg Seminary teaches men in the Philippines, and we have over 60 men we teach on Zoom in Kenya.
Yeah.
And so.
Okay. Well, if it's plug time, I have to mention.
Well, City Seminary teaches men in the Spanish language.
Yes.
All right. If it's plug time, I'm going to mention Seminario Reformado de las Americas, which is the Latin American seminary. That is our sister seminary to City Seminary. It's based in Quito, Ecuador, under the able stewardship down there of URC Pastor Pablo Landazari, dear man. And it's a three forms continental reformed seminary. Our board of visitors, which we have, includes not only Dennis Rowe, you know, from the RCUS, who's the head of, you know, Westminster Biblical Missions, but Barry York from the RP Seminary, Jonathan Master from Greenville is on that board, Adrian Neely, president up at Puritan Reformed, Mark Vanderhart is on that board, Chris McCaffrey. I'm going to forget somebody
Familiar names. Yeah,
and then Richard Bout, you know, the mission coordinator of the URC, and the clerk of the URC is Ralph Pontier, is the chairman of the board of visitors. So the idea was to try to avoid the fracturing that we often see in the U.S. and try to get everybody to cooperate. Let's plant the flag for the confessional reformed faith in Latin America. It's an area that we've neglected.
Yeah,
and so many churches have, you know, fledgling Spanish language ministries now, but we have nobody training genuinely reformed Spanish pastor. We had our first two graduates, you know, we're 4 years old, so going on our fourth year. So we had our first two graduates in December and both working in mission church situations already. And so now we're pretty excited. We never thought we were going to be doing that. We were going to try to train pastors here. And just like Maynard never thought they were going to be training, you know, a whole cadre of guys in the Philippines, but the Lord had different, here's the one advantage of a smaller church. And that is that everybody can be involved, you know, directly in the ministry. You're not just reading a report, you know, but it's very hands-on. We try to right size the works that we work on. You know, we pick on mission fields and projects that we can do. We're certainly willing and eager to cooperate with other people. We try to lend a hand when we can, but we don't just farm it out to, you know, a bunch of paid experts. You know, it can happen with a mission committee and so forth. We have no permanent headquarters in the RCUS. We don't have a building. You know, that's always been eschewed. You know, the emphasis is always bottom up. You know, the life of the church is in the pews and in the pulpits, and I think that distinguishes us as well. But hey, we're looking so forward to getting together, seeing you guys, you know, out at the and you can, anybody who would like to come is certainly welcome to register and come on out.
So where do we go to do that? What are some of the details for people who might want to come out to the celebration?
If you go to rcus.org, that's the easiest way, and from there you can navigate to other things. If you want more information, info@rcus.org.
Okay.
And I've got that on my feed, so I'll be one of the ones that sees that. So if you have questions about Spanish language ministry or the Philippines, I can make sure that gets to the right place. The questions about, you know, there's so many small independent Reformed churches out there, that are wary, and rightly so, of denominations, because, well, let's face it, Brother Grossman, who's bound to be with the Lord, but he would say, well, now when the RCUS goes liberal, and it will, or he'd say, when this such and such seminary goes liberal, and it will, you know, he said that as a refrain, just as said, you know, don't put your faith in bricks and mortar. You know, you never want to leave the fact that you're sustained by the Spirit of God. And that's where your strength is, and that's the only thing that should keep you. And if you don't have that, I hope they do die. I hope that the institution.
That's what our 300 year celebration is going to be. It's not 300 years of our accomplishment. It's 300 years of the Lord's blessing.
Amen. The Lord has done.
Preach the gospel and continue to do so today.
Well, I'm excited about that. That's going to be great.
Camden, I'll tell you, because I'm not a podcast guy, but, you know, finding Reform Forum and what you guys are doing, it, I got a lot to go back and listen to.
Yeah, not all of them would be
Ted
worth
Dingus
it.
But on, you know, recently, a friend of ours in down south, you know, I said, I gotta see more of this.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate what you're doing.
Well, thank you.
And the ministry that you guys are doing is just terrific. It's another one of those touchstones that help us to realize that we're not alone. You know,
no.
There's a lot of us out there, a lot of places on the wall where different people are working.
Right.
You know.
Amen. Yeah, and that's one thing. One great privilege I have in doing this and talking to so many different people over the years. We've been doing this for 17 years now, but I love speaking with all of our brothers and sisters in other denominations, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And that's the way it ought to be. If we have a confessional identity, we have in many ways a shared heritage, but we should be working together. We should remain, I think it's good and healthy to have these ecumenical relations so that we can have our firm convictions in each of our particular churches and expressions of faith there. But there is an ecumenical faith. We do hold, the Westminster Standards and the three forms of unity are very compatible, and we should partner with one another and encourage one another as much as possible. And I think that's what we do see exampled, at least in the relations between the RCUS and the OPC, but the URC as well. So many faithful denominations in our country.
So much interaction over the years between OPC and RCUS because of, you know, Westminster East, that's where so many of them went to school together. So that really helped build a lot of bridges and a lot of contacts and people, you know, a lot of them. Now we got Presbyterian daughters and sons marrying the sons and daughters in the Reformed Church. And so now there's all these family connections.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been really wonderful for us.
Well, that's good. Well, I would want to encourage people. I'll put the various links necessary in the episode description. You can follow up and learn more, not only about the RCUS and about the celebration in June. Ryan, Noah, and I will be there, and we'll be a good Presbyterian encourager, as we hope. I've got no daughters to try to pawn off on any of you guys, but I got some sons, so if we want to take some good German girls into
that
our...
That wasn't a plug. Yeah, I was just talking. It did happen.
Well, I can't seize the opportunity for the joke. But of course, we'll follow up and have links as well to not only Heidelberg Theological Seminary there in Sioux Falls, but as Wayne mentioned, of course, City Seminary of Sacramento. And certainly, we'd love for people to follow up. If I may put a little bit of a plug in for somebody who's very interested in OP history, but if you're interested in Westminster history as well, I've got a couple different versions in the office here of the book, History of the Eureka Classis. At least the version I've got is Hofflinger and Stuba. But there's been a couple different, there was a revision at one point, but that's a wonderful book if you can get a copy of that. And what I was so astounded was Wayne was talking about the Westminster connection. I'm just flipping through that book and just looking at the pictures from all these different classes and synod meetings. I'm like, hey, that's an OP guy. I'm like, I'm seeing all these faces. I know it's Harvey Kahn. Look at, hey, it's Van Til. Yeah. There's Van Til again. And it just goes to show that history is intertwined as it should be.
No, it was a lifeline for us. Mm-hmm. It really was, you know. So
it's fun.
We appreciate it.
Praise the Lord. Well, brothers, it's been a pleasure to talk with you both. I'll encourage everyone to take a look at reformedforum.org, follow up with the episode description in your podcast player or on the website or on YouTube, wherever you're watching or listening to this. And we'll certainly want to follow up and perhaps dig down more into detail in some of these chapters of history and future episodes. But until then, I do want to thank everybody for listening and for watching. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.